Well, I want to thank you for your attendance tonight. Thank you for those of you who could be here last night. Thank you for joining our study. We are looking at the topic throughout this series of gospel meetings of the idea of the superiority of Christ. And the elders have asked me to take from the primary text of Colossians chapter 2 that we'll review in just a moment. There are six things that are mentioned within that text as Paul talks to the Christians at Colossae. And one of those we're going to discuss tonight is the idea of the superiority of Christ to human philosophy. And so I have borrowed from Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23 as our title tonight is just the idea that Jeremiah cries to the Lord, "I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps." Yet human philosophy tries that very thing. Human philosophy attempts to direct our steps in the absence of God, to bring meaning to meaninglessness, to give reason and purpose to chaos and confusion. And as we'll demonstrate tonight in our primary text, that becomes impossible without factoring in God. In other words, without God, we cannot answer the larger questions that we ask as life, as we face the day-to-day issues of our life. And so that's what we're going to consider tonight. So kind of remember that theme, that Christ is superior to human philosophy. And all of us deal with human philosophy on a day-to-day basis. If you don't have to look around very long. You don't have to be in the academic community. We all face those who have given into the idea of human philosophy as being superior to, as they see it, the superstition of what they would refer to as traditional Christianity. So tonight, I put this up there, I realize the font's pretty small, but I wanted to get it all on one sheet to kind of demonstrate. In Colossians chapter 2, only 23 verses to that text. We read it last night. But highlighted in yellow are those things which jump out at us that become the six primary issues that Paul makes a case for. Christ is superior to these things because those were the issues that these brethren were faced with. They were the issues that were in competition with the with Christ and the superiority of Christ. And so when we look at these things, what we see is the idea of Paul warning them, don't let anybody deceive you with persuasive words, with philosophy, with empty deceit. The authority of principalities and power, the idea of civil government or secular government.
And I believe some did.
Of angels, we'll talk about that on Sunday morning with mysticism. And then self-imposed religion, we'll talk about a little bit later on in our series as well. But tonight, we're going to focus on this idea of human philosophy. The idea, and Paul brings it up. Paul mentions it in that text because they dealt with it. There are some things that I notice as I study history and as I study God's Word. There are things that are timeless. I think that's the beauty of the Word of God, is that it makes no difference if you were a first century Colossian or a 21st century Tennessean. This text applies to you. It fits the circumstances in which you are in. It is there. It is profitable for the application to your daily life and to your spiritual life. It is as meaningful now as it was then. So that's what we're going to focus on tonight, is the superiority of Christ over human philosophy. To do that, we are going to go to my favorite text, and that is the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you have your Bibles before you, if you would, turn over to the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to think about the message of the preacher in Ecclesiastes, because I can think of no better demonstration and no place where a writer of inspired nature wrestles with this idea of the superiority of divine understanding to human philosophy. That's what is central to the message of the preacher of Ecclesiastes. He wrestles with that idea, and so that's what we're going to focus on. That we're going to focus on this evening. A study of Ecclesiastes, and especially this theme that is his theme, and our subtitle, that all is vanity, is kind of a philosophical consideration. But it is juxtaposing two philosophies. It is either the philosophy of humans or divine philosophy, and which one is better? And that's really what is at the heart of this, and he considers this with this key phrase that we'll talk about a little bit more in detail in just a moment, is all is vanity. And so it is a philosophical question, but it's not merely lofty academics. There are deeper issues and practical issues and questions that face all of civilization that the preacher of Ecclesiastes considers. Why am I here? What's the meaning of life? What is all of this leading to? Why, as my children often ask me, is life not fair? It's not fair. You know, they come to you and they say, well, it's not fair, Daddy. And my response has always been, get used to it. You're going to see a lot of that. You know what? The preacher of Ecclesiastes said the same thing. Get used to it. You're going to see a lot of that. It does puzzle us. That doesn't seem fair. That doesn't seem just. And so he wrestles with these things. Why is life so difficult? Why can't it be easy? Why can't we just have some peace? Why can't we just get along? Why can't we have a moment of contentment? And so all of us wrestle with that. They are timeless questions. Everybody wrestles with them. The fortunate thing that the Christian has is that we have faith in the philosophy, the divine philosophy over human philosophy. As soon we begin to find out, there are answers to these questions. There is an answer. But there is no answer, as we'll demonstrate in just a moment, if we try to separate the answer from divine philosophy and divine reasoning and understanding. If we take a look at the book of Ecclesiastes, we're going to look for a moment at the theme. This, a friend of mine referred to as the black sheep of the black sheep of the Bible. This is a different book from most of the others. It doesn't take long to look at it. You begin to read it and you recognize this is a little bit different, a little bit different book from the others. The theme is the question of the greater issues of our life. The writer contrasts a life that is lived with the knowledge, the understanding, and the submission to God. He contrasts and compares that to life as he describes under the sun. That's his code for separated from God. And his conclusion is, life separated from an understanding of God is meaningless. You're not going to find the answers. And that's where divine and human philosophy clash. Because philosophy says you can have the answers in the absence of God. The writer of Ecclesiastes says, no way. No way. And he begins to demonstrate that through the course of the book. As you look at the book, one of the things that you notice, I brought this up last night, I am a big believer in this, and that is key words. And there are a couple of key phrases within the book, and we'll point these out as we go along, but this one used 37 times in these 12 short chapters is the idea of vanity, also in some cases translated either futility or meaninglessness, and it is from the Hebrew hebel, which is a breath or a vapor. In other words, it's hard to get your arms around. It's there and then it's gone. It dissipates. And so that's the idea. It's vanity. It's meaningless. It's futile. I can't contain it. I can't control it. I can't get my arms around it. That's the key word. And we would include synonyms like fleeting or empty or worthless or deceitful. It's the same kind of concept that he is conveying in this key word, and it is used again, and we'll talk about another phrase that is used over and over in just a moment. The book is unique in its nature. If for no other reason, the book stands out amongst the rest of the Bible as unique just in the manner in which it is written, because on the surface, it appears to question the philosophy of God. He's wrestling with some things that we may wrestle with, but not necessarily want to articulate. It seems in places that he's questioning the philosophy of God. That almost the point that he is laying, he's laying things at the feet of God, almost in a blaming way. He's wrestling with these things and concerning himself with these things. And I would argue that we have a tendency to do the same thing as we wrestle with the nature of this life. Yet the book is very practical. When you take the book and you begin to pull it apart, you begin to peel the layers back, you find that there are numerous things that apply to us on a regular basis. There is the talk of work ethic. There is the talk of contentment. There is the talk of seeking God's favor early in one's life. There is the talk of living a life of moderation and simplicity with a God-centered worldview. There's great significance in the title of the book as well. We would say, if we were going to take this, if we were going to take this book, let me go right to the next slide. If we were going to take this book, we would refer to it as the preacher. The Hebrew there, koeleth or koelet, it means to convoke an assembly or to assemble. In the Greek, ecclesiastes, one who stands before an assembly, and the Latin ecclesiastes. And so here, the conclusion on the part of most scholars is that this is written by Solomon. And his identity is given, the King of Jerusalem, but his name is never used. And so we're going to stick with what we know for sure is that this is the preacher. I think it's Solomon, but I'm going to stick with what I know for sure. And that is, this is the preacher. And so that's how we'll refer to him as the author of this, or a gatherer, or a speaker of God's people as we go through. So let's talk a little bit about the experience of this preacher. Turn over to chapter 1, if you would, and let's look at this, the experience of this man. Now, if we make the proper, I think, conclusion that this is Solomon, scholars tell us that this book was written at the very end of his life. That he wrote Song of Solomon as a young man, Proverbs in his middle age, and Ecclesiastes at the very end of his life. And if you remember from the historical accountings in the books of Kings about his life, we remember that Solomon is always known for a few things. He's known for his works, he's known for his women, and he is known for his wisdom. Now, some people would question the wisdom of a man who would want 1,000 wives. But yet, you know, that's what we kind of know. Those are the three big things we know him for. But there's another thing that is important as we consider this particular letter, is that we also know something about Solomon that's kind of, that can seem like an anomaly amongst spiritual people, is that he turned his back on God not as a young man, but at the end of his life. He was an older man. He was a mature man when he decided, I'm going to give in to the temptation of these idols and bring them in to Israel and the effect that it had on Israel and so on. Solomon left God as an older man, not as a teenager. And so it seems, as this book progresses, particularly in chapter 12, that he is, I think, this is my view, take it for what it's worth, that there are the beginnings of repentance here, because it seems as though when you get to chapter 12, as he tells the young people, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, that he is pining over the decisions that he has made as an older man. That he is beginning to feel the regret of turning from God. And he is warning a younger audience, there are no answers set apart from God. So for all of you young folks, and the young at heart, I'm getting to the point in life where I don't talk about old people anymore. I'm getting there. Hester told me when I sat down in the car tonight, she said, you're too young to grunt and groan like that when you sit down. And I said, no, to tell my knees that. No, I'm not. I'm getting old. So all of the young and the young at heart, but the physically young, Solomon's writing this to you with the perspective of all of these years of experience and the regret of turning on God. He can now begin to consider some of these greater issues. And so notice chapter 1, verse 13 first. In verse 13, Solomon says, "And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind." I make the statement on this chart that this is the great experiment. Now let me say, whether intentional or incidental, I don't imagine that one day Solomon woke up, or the preacher woke up, and said, "I'm going to conduct a great moral experiment." I don't think that's probably what happened. I think it probably happened incidentally. But the point is this, is that in the first two chapters, he begins laying out, here are the objects that where I tried to find meaning in life. Here are the things. And so he mentions in this text, in chapter 1 and verse 13, also in chapter 1 and verse 17, he starts by saying, it's a burdensome task. He says in verse 17, "I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly." In chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4, he expands this a little bit. He said, "I said to my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great, I built myself houses, and I planted myself vineyards." And he goes on in the following verses and continues. If we look at chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, he says, "Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Then I looked on the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity, and grasping for the wind, there was no profit under the sun." The preacher of Ecclesiastes sought numerous sources. And I want to point out, in a timeless nature, he sought out the same sources that we search for meaning and contentment today. He looked to academic wisdom. He looked to fun, enjoyment, the flesh. He specifically mentions wine. And he looked to occupational accomplishment. My friends, my experience in life tells me those are exactly the same things that everybody around us is running this rat race trying to find meaning in. And the preacher's conclusion is, it was all vanity, grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. You get to this point in the text and you feel his depression sinking in. "I have come to the end of my life. I am well known. I am popular. I am powerful. I have accomplished things that other men only dream of. I am wise. I am smart. I have tested all these things. And I look back at my life and it doesn't mean anything." Sound familiar? It is the exact same thing that we wrestle with today. I want my next promotion. I want to be so. You know, when I mentioned last night, I was assigned here in 1986 to Fort Campbell, brand new second lieutenant. And in my mind, as I drove in post, it's been a long time since I've been over there, but when you drove in the main gate, the CG's house was right there to the right, the big, big white house on the historical registry. And I can remember as a second lieutenant driving in that gate right there and thinking, one of these days, General Sayre's going to be living in that big house. I'm going to be on top of the heap. I'm going to chase this career. There's nobody like me wearing uniform. You know what I found pretty soon? I was pretty good at it, but I was also just one of the boys. And pretty soon reality began setting in. Said, "You're not going to make general officer there, sport." And matter of fact, I tell people all the time, I've already been promoted twice past my potential. I'm surprised I've made it as far as I have. But we begin to have those delusions of grandeur, don't we? We say, I'm going to be the CEO, I'm going to be the president, I'm going to be president of the university, I'm going to be the best, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. If it's not that, I'm going to have fun, I'm going to enjoy, you know, the bucket list. I'm going to skydive, I'm going to climb Mount Everest, I'm going to do all of these things. I'm going to get my degrees, I'm going to be smart, I'm going to be published. And you know what? We almost everyone come to the same conclusion that he did. All those things meant nothing. So what? It doesn't mean anything. At least in certain circumstances. We can't answer those great questions. We can't have contentment if we try to do it separated from God. And so I want us to notice four key things in the manifestation of this vanity, because this is the way he formulates or formats his conclusions. Is that there are certain ways that vanity is manifested. If you would, notice again, chapter 1, verses 3 through 11. We chose some choice passages from that. But he makes these points about the idea of working but getting nowhere. Ever had one of those days? Ever had one of those days that about 20 minutes into this day, you think, you know, it would be great just to go back and crawl in bed and hit the reset button because I'm getting nowhere already? Well, he makes the point, the world is fraught with activity. He talks about the circuits of nature, the sun, the moon, the stars, the weather patterns. And it all leads nowhere. It just, same thing happens every day, and it all leads nowhere. Life's just one big treadmill. History itself even seems to have a repetitive cycle. You ever notice how we make the same mistakes? Humans have a tendency just to keep making the same mistakes. Each generation believes that it's going to leave a mark on history, but the reality is, history normally leaves a mark on you. And so the preacher wrestles with all this and says, look, there's just vanity in working but getting nowhere. I'm killing myself here, but I'm getting nowhere. He goes on to continue with the second point, the vanity of advancing but not obtaining. We buy into the idea that if we could somehow break out of our small and limited lives, if we could become someone and climb the ladder, that the view would be better. It would all make sense and we would all be satisfied. And I want you to think about this. I said to myself, my wife and I were talking one time and I said, you know what? We were facing, you know, like everybody, we go through different financial times. We were facing a little debt. I said, you know what, honey? Now, this has been a long time ago because this wouldn't go as far. I said, if we had $5,000, we'd be set. If I only, and think about how many times you've thought that if you've not articulated. If only I had, fill in the blank, I'd be happy. If only I had a new car. For me as a young man, if only I had a bass boat. Happiest days of my life were the day I bought it and the day I sold it. Sunk more money into that thing. Never caught a fish out of it either. It was very, very, very disappointing. Think hard before you make that decision. But the vanity, that idea of advancing and working and thinking, and the reality is, I'm not obtaining what I'm looking for. I might be putting away, but not what I'm looking for. He looked for meaning in wisdom, in fun, in accomplishment, in possessions, in entertainment. And the conclusion was a pretty dreary one. His conclusion was, in chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, I'm not finding what I'm looking for here. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, he looks at the vanity of fleshly pleasure. He attempted the same distractions people attempt today. He sought meaning and purpose and contentment in what is so ridiculously referred to as the good life. Because all it brings in reality is pain. It is a flash in the pan when it comes to pleasure. All it brings is pain. He said, it is grasping for the wind. It is worthless. He contemplates the idea in chapter 2, verses 18 through 23, of the vanity of losing by gain. The reality is that we don't have control over it after we're gone. He makes this idea. He realizes this concept that I have accomplished all of this. I have built this empire. And you know who I'm going to leave it to? The person behind me who didn't lift a finger to build this empire, who didn't do anything to put this together. And guess what they're going to do with it? They're going to let it slip through their hands. Not long ago, near our home in East Tennessee, I saw this beautiful family farm go on sale. It was gorgeous. Things like this just make me want to break down and cry. But I never have, you know, $1 million to do anything about it. So, this beautiful family farm had been going on, had been run by the same family for generations. The kind of the patriarch of the family passed away. And the auctioneer shows up. And they're going to sell this beautiful farm off in 1 acre lots to build another subdivision. Just made me want to cry. Generation after generation after generation of man put his sweat and his blood and his toil, and the children didn't want it, but what they could hear is the cash register going off for that high dollar land. And I just wanted to weep. That's exactly what the preacher is saying. I have built this, and my children are going to sell it off an acre at a time. It is worthless. There are no answers yet. When we get to the end of chapter 2, if you'd never read Ecclesiastes before, you would want to cry. But you start to feel his pain. You begin to understand. You begin to connect. Because the reality is, at some point in our lives, all of us feel like that. We wrestle with the same things that the preacher wrestled with. And all too often for Christians, we know intellectually I'm supposed to feel differently about all of this. And we begin to feel guilty. I think the preacher did the same thing. And that's what drove him to search for the answers that he was looking for. And so let's think about the point of his message. In chapter 3 and verse 11, if you'll read along in this passage, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. It is that key phrase that I want you to focus on in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11. He said he has put eternity in their hearts. We're going to come back to that thought later in our study. In modern language, I would tell you what I think he's trying to say there is you are hardwired in your DNA to believe in God. You are hardwired to believe that there are answers out there, that it is not meaningless, that life is about something. You might not have the answer right now. We are hardwired to believe there is hope. There is a God. There is something bigger. It's easy for us to believe that because He made us that way. Eternity is in your heart. You have to do some serious convincing to change your heart. Because it is hardwired in you that eternity is there. And so when we begin to interpret all of this, because now he's starting to change. You get to the end of chapter 2, it's a pretty depressing picture. You get to the end of chapter 2, you're just like, man, is he a cynic? Is he burned out? Is he about to give in and quit and just throw in the towel and say, forget it, I've had enough, I quit, I want out. Because, you know, we feel like that sometimes. We know how he feels. We wrestle with the same things. But then in chapter 3, he starts coming back. And in effect, he is saying, no, there is an answer. Here's the positive. And now, although it's enigmatic, now he begins to give us what were at one time seeming contradictions. Now he is going to begin to explain. And so when we begin to interpret this message, all is vanity, there are things that we need to think about. There are things that we need to understand to interpret it properly. There are three initial rules that we need to make sure that we understand. You cannot understand this book based on a superficial reading, and I'll tell you why. It seems on the surface to be contradictory. It's like, preacher, make up your mind. Is life meaningless or is life great? Which one? On the surface, it seems like this is out of kilter. It's contradicting. Secondly, we have to guard against making conclusions that the writer doesn't make. The writer never makes the conclusion life doesn't matter or how you live doesn't matter. He never makes that conclusion. He just says, there's some complicating questions out there that make it seem as though life can be meaningless. And we have to harmonize this message with the balance of all other Scripture. And so that's our challenge when we look at this, when we look at the idea of the superiority of Christ's philosophy over human philosophy. And so while all is vanity is the theme of this book, the key to understanding the message is to view it in light of the setting where the observations are made. Let me explain. Where the observations are made is life under the sun, used 29 times. 37 times he says all is vanity. 29 times accompanied with that in conjunction is that phrase, under the sun. Here's what I believe the preacher is trying to express to us. In chapters 1 and 2, he is dealing with the big issues, the big methods in which humankind tries to find meaning. Knowledge, wisdom, pleasure, fun, accomplishment, work, money, all of those things that we all get too wrapped up in. Then beginning in chapter 3, he begins to make a case, however, life is only vanity. Life is only meaningless when you consider it from the perspective of under the sun. Under the sun is code for without God. If God is not factored in, it is a logical conclusion to conclude that life is meaningless. You know what? I get it. That's absolutely correct. When I hear the humanist, the atheist, the agnostic say, there are no answers to the great questions of life, I say, you know, from your perspective, I would have to come to the same conclusion. If you're going to factor God out, you're right. It is meaningless. You might as well try to find contentment in human accomplishment. Because look, if you believe this is all you're going to get, I'll be honest with you. I don't know how an atheist gets out of bed every day, draws breath, and puts his feet on the floor. If I thought this, I got a great life. I got a wonderful wife. Those of you who know my wife, when they invented the phrase "your better half" for her, she's great. Love her. Love being with her. Children, great. You know, they drive you nuts every now and then. Love them. Like to be around them. I've got a good job. I enjoy my job. I have what I need physically. My wife has got a little bumper sticker on the front of her car, one of those happy faces that says life is good. That's kind of her motto. But you know why life is good? Because she believes in God. She recognizes if I didn't believe in God, life wouldn't be good. Life would be hard to explain. Life would be meaningless. Life wouldn't be worth getting out of bed in the morning. But with God, he says, that's life. That's vanity. All is vanity when considering it under the sun. If you're going to take God out of the equation, his conclusion is you better believe it's meaningless. But with God, there is a difference. Without heaven's insights and foresights, what can we make of earthly living? It's an absurd, meaningless venture. In spite of all of the hard work, the prudence, the discipline, the talent, the skill, even some luck thrown in there, it all means nothing. The conclusion that all is vanity is one that every human that lives on the face of the earth has considered at one point or another. We've all wrestled with this. And usually, the longer that we live, the more that the reality of Ecclesiastes begin to ring true. You lose your job. You get cheated out of the promotion. Your car breaks down. Your house burns. Your children get sick. Your children get involved in immorality or something that you don't want to happen to them. And so the longer you live, the reality is the first two chapters begin to become concreted in your experience. But then we continue. And so the point of the message of Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11, eternity is in their hearts. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Not contradictory. He's now going to consider life with God. And so he begins to bring forward for our understanding, and let me skip one more, for our understanding some islands of hope and faith. A friend of mine describes it like this. He said, this is what reading Ecclesiastes is like. Reading Ecclesiastes is like walking through a field in a thunderstorm. And you're bumbling your way through the dark, and every now and then there is a flash of lightning. For a split second, you can see clearly, just like it's noonday. And that's a good description of this book, because there's all this bad news, there's all the meaninglessness, there's all of the wrestling with these things, and then all of a sudden you read a passage that says, life is good. You got to look at it from a different perspective, but life is good. The lightning flashes, and in chapter 5, verses 1 through 2, we see this idea that the preacher carries forth for us. He says, walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear, rather than to give sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. He makes the point, come before God. The answer is with God. Chapter 8, verses 12 through 13. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before Him, but it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. The preacher says, in a flash of brilliant light, in all of this obscurity, the preacher says, don't worry about the sinner who prolongs life. God will see to that. You have a blessing in that you fear God. I think this is the preacher's way of saying what my grandmother used to tell me, you've got enough trouble taking care of yourself to worry about everybody else. Be concerned. Don't concern yourself with what may seem unfair. May seem unfair on the surface. The preacher says, put it out of your mind. Have faith and have hope in God. That's where the answer is. Lives. Chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. We're going to return to this a little bit later on. I think this is the most hopeful. It is his conclusion. And again, we'll come back to this in just a moment or so. But he said, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Now remember, we have now for 12 chapters, if you read this book, we have now for 12 chapters wrestled with this topic. We have wrestled with the idea of human philosophy versus divine philosophy. We have wrestled with the idea of what does life really mean? Why it really isn't fair. Why does the sinner's life last longer? One would think that God would take him out of the equation. Why does the sinner get ahead in his career and here I am sitting in the same job for the last 20 years? That's not fair, Lord. Once we've wrestled with that for 12 chapters, and there's a lot of other positive things just for the sake of time and one lesson we can't get to, but he comes to this conclusion. He says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. The preacher is saying, you want to know the secret to life? You want to know why you're here? You want to know why life is not meaningless? You know why life is special? You know what life can be accomplished? You want to look back at your life at the conclusion on your deathbed and say, my life meant something. He says, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. In other words, this is your mission on earth. Fear God and keep His commandments. Nothing else is significant. I often, as I read this text, think about my grandfather and all of his friends. Sixth grade education, had enough insurance when he died to put him in the ground, and he did not care. Didn't bother him. Not one bit. As a matter of fact, he didn't think there were too many people out there that was a better man than him. He didn't mean it haughtily. He actually meant it in humility. He had a God-centered character. That's what I think he's trying to tell us here. Forget about all that stuff. I was wrong pursuing the folly. I was wrong pursuing the good time. I was wrong pursuing the wisdom. I was wrong to pursue the career and all of that. That's not where meaning in life comes. Meaning in life comes from fearing my Creator and living for Him by keeping His commandments. That's what gives life meaning. That is man's mission statement. You want to know why you're here? That's why you're here. You know what? You want to know why life is good and why life does have meaning? That's why. Fear God and keep His commandments. Live for God. You want something to live for? There is no higher calling. Everything else is just a detail. Everything else is insignificant. And so here is where I believe, let's skip forward one more. Here's how we begin to maneuver through all of this. This is where I think, as we begin to work through this text, that we begin to see that it's actually, Ecclesiastes starts out, chapter 1 and 2, pretty depressing, I think. But then you begin to continue through the text. Here's what this is my conclusion anyway. Ecclesiastes is liberating. Ecclesiastes is actually empowering. Because it's given me the key to the secret of life. This is it. This is why I'm here. You don't have to backpack Europe to figure out who you are. You can sit right here and read those two verses at the conclusion of Ecclesiastes and figure out why you're here. And what you're supposed to do and who you are. It's liberating. It wakes us up to this truth. It reminds us of the frustration and the emptiness. They are not unique. They are the common lot of mankind. But there are answers when we consider things beyond life under the sun without God. And so, here are some things that I want to leave you with when we begin to consider the idea, when we begin to consider the contrast between human philosophy and divine philosophy. Here are, I believe, key points. Number one, all of us need to learn to have realistic expectations about this life on earth. Here's part of our problem. We expect too much out of this. Our expectations are not grounded in divine truth. We expect too much out of this life. We expect truth, justice in the American way. We expect that somebody is going to rush to see that justice is done. We expect to see all of these things. We just want too much out of this. Don't get me wrong. I think it's good to have a positive outlook on life. I think it's good to look for the good. That's a wonderful thing. I think positive attitude will take you a long way. But you're always going to end up disappointed if you expect too much out of life. I had a sergeant that was very influential on me when I was a young soldier, and he told me up front, very early in my life as a soldier, he said, "Son," he said, "the sooner you get used to the idea that you're going to spend the next 25 to 30 years miserable, the happier you'll be." And you know what? At the time, my little 18-year-old mind couldn't get my arms around that. I said, "There is no way that's right." You know what? He was right. Because really, that it wasn't miserable, but his point was, don't expect too much out of this life. Times are going to be hard. Once you accept that, once your expectations are not tremendously high of what life can give you, and you begin to focus on God, and your expectations can be tremendous. Matter of fact, I don't believe we can even tap into the potential of the joy and the wonder that God can give us. We don't need to expect too much of this. We need to expect out of life what Ecclesiastes teaches, at the same time strive for what the New Testament promises. The second point that I think is helpful for us as we look at this and maneuver through all this is that we focus on enjoyment rather than accomplishment. After his discuss with the vanity of labor in chapter 1, after his admission that God is in control and we humans really don't know what's happening in chapter 3 and verse 22, is not the wise man telling us to enjoy whatever we have, little or much, and not become caught up in the idea of attaining more. It is the work, chapter 5 and verse 18, it is the work, not necessarily the completion of the project, that we should draw enjoyment from. Confucius does not get the credit for saying it's not the destination, it's the journey. Koheleth does. That's his point. He does. Take contentment in the simple things. Take contentment not in the finishing of the project, but in the working of the project, in the doing of, in the occupation. It's not the end, it's not the destination, it's the journey. Men, we need to learn this more than those who sit next to us. We have that tendency. I've got it bad. I have my list. I cross that off. I don't enjoy it for 10 seconds. I say, all right, honey, what's next? What empire do you need conquered now? Because I have slain that dragon for you. And I can't even enjoy the doing. And we need to learn that. Koheleth makes that point. Make your aim a righteous character rather than an earthly outcome. When you draw your last, it won't make any difference the accolades that hang on your wall. It won't make any difference the money that is in your bank account. It won't make any difference the accomplishments that you have done in this life if you have never committed yourself to fearing God and keeping His commandments. Life will have been for naught. It will have been a wasted life. What sadness it would be to look back at life and say, I wasted my only opportunity. We can expect life to be a ladder by which we climb to the top. But I think it's probably more accurate in light of the message of the preacher of Ecclesiastes to view it as a merry-go-round. It's more healthy to accept the fact that the same problems and the same challenges will come our way, and the goal of life is not surpassing them, but in fact facing them each time with a righteous character. Divine philosophy is superior to human philosophy. When we look at the idea of human philosophy, this is the best synopsis of humanism that I could find from the humanist Ayn Rand. My philosophy, quote, my philosophy in essence is the concept of man as a heroic being with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity, and reason as his only absolute. All is vanity. If you buy into that philosophy, all is vanity. Life will be meaningless. You will never answer the questions. You will never find meaning if you buy into human philosophy. You will never find the answer. You will never find contentment, because what is not considered here is that happiness is a fleeting thing. Achievement is short-lived. And reason, as we discussed last night, set apart from the reason and the wisdom of God, comes up short over and over. Here's the contrast. The contrast comes from Koheleth. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. Don't buy into the humanistic idea. Don't buy into the superiority, the idea that is in our world that human philosophy is superior to Christ. It is not. It won't answer the questions. It won't give meaning. The preacher of Ecclesiastes says, Life under the sun, separated from God, is worthless. Life with God is everything. It's all in how you look at it. It's always amazed me how two people can look at the same thing, and one be in the depths of depression and the other one say, it'll be all right. I'm married to one of those, it'll be all right people. Thankfully. They can see, it's okay. God's in control. It's all right. It'll work out. God's in control. Even if I don't get justice, I will get mercy from God. God will give me the strength. He is my rock. These truths can certainly strike a chord in someone's heart who is currently feeling the weight of a loss or a tragedy. Yet even those who are riding high can benefit. Solomon was riding high when he wrote these words. He was the king of Israel. Never have there been in history more people enjoying themselves more than people in modern America. If you don't believe me, turn the TV on any given Sunday afternoon. People in this country, despite the vulgarity of talking about a bad economy in a place that has more stuff than any place else in the world combined, we are having a ball. And we're going to go over a cliff. Chasing things that mean nothing. Never has there been a society of people with the tools and the opportunities to find meaning and fulfillment in life under the sun. And never have the people been so empty spiritually. Ecclesiastes is afresh right now, as it was the moment the writer lifted his pen from the paper. The book's shocking realism is the first step in waking up. The underlying hope found in it and the rest of the Bible's message is man's only hope. If you turn your back on this message, you will never find meaning to this life. It will be empty. It will be a vapor. It will be vanity. Your only answer is through the superiority of the wisdom and the philosophy of Jesus Christ. Your only answer for these questions are found in Him. If you're here tonight and you've not walked with God, you've not made your decision to become a child of God, you have opportunity to do so here and now. If you are moved by your faith based on your hearing and your understanding of His Word, if you're willing to change your life, if you're willing to repent, and I would impress upon you, too many people have the idea of repentance as a single point of focus. It is a lifelong work in progress. It is a transformation. It continues. But if you're willing to start that, if you're willing to confess and give your loyalty to Christ as your Savior, to be baptized in the waters of baptism, as Paul makes the point, to rise and walk in newness of life. If you're here tonight, subject to that invitation and willing to give your life to God and to find meaning in this life and to leave that vanity behind you, tonight you can do so by coming while we stand together and while we sing.